just a pleasure to welcome back Nick Barashev, President and CEO of Bullion Management Group. That's BMG, widely known as an international bullion and precious metals expert and author of the must-read 10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. And it looks like 2018 will be that year, as I'm sure we'll get into today. Welcome, Nick Barashev.
My pleasure.
So great to have you. This is going to be the year. This is where we break out. We've been waiting for this consolidating backing and filling for over 2 years, and there's signs of life in the XAU shares, even silver tossed out with the bathwater silver. So give us an idea of your outlook on 2018, please.
Well, I think it's a positive year, and I did a recent speech at the Empire Club, outlined some of the major trend shifts that have kept the gold price suppressed and how they've either, you know, about to end or change radically. And that's where I think there's no stopping these sort of macro trend shifts that are taking place. And in most cases, these are not covered by the mainstream media, so people are totally unaware that all of this is happening in the background.
Exactly. That really puts us in a quandary, doesn't it? What does the everyday investor do?
The issue that I've preached ever since we've been here is that first starting point that investors need to start with is diversification. And this is where there's a huge misconception. You know, everybody seems to believe in diversification, but they don't implement. The typical investment portfolio is 60-40 stocks and bonds. That is simply not diversification. There are seven asset classes in total. So there's cash, stocks, bonds, commodities, real estate, precious metals, and collectibles. And I say, okay, for purposes of dealing with your financial advisor, he's not going to deal with collectibles, but collectibles are like numismatic coins, arts, exotic cars, whatever you want there. That's something that you have to develop personal expertise to deal with. But when you do, then collectibles become a hobby that in many cases will outperform financial assets. Since I'm a bit of a car buff, if you take a 1970, I think it's 71 Daytona Ferrari, which wasn't a particularly good car, it looked like a Datsun 240Z. And they were 17,000 back then in 1971. Today they're 2.5 million, and you got to drive it on Sunday afternoons. You know, so collectibles can be very good, but let's take those off the table. The other thing that you can take off the table is commodities, because unless you've got a lot of expertise in the futures contracts, that there isn't any meaningful way to buy commodities. Like, you can't buy a truckload of lumber and store it for 20 years. So commodities are a little tougher for most portfolios other than institutional or very wealthy investors. So basically, you're left with stocks, bonds, cash, real estate, and precious metals. So the reason it makes up a diversified portfolio is because of the negative correlation. And this always blows my mind, because Harry Markowitz got a Nobel Prize for modern portfolio theory. So here's a quote from him. In order to reduce risk, it's necessary to avoid a portfolio whose securities are all highly correlated with each other. 100 securities whose returns rise and fall in near unison afford little protection than the uncertain return of a single security. What you have to do is mix your asset categories so that there's a degree of non-correlation between the asset classes. The asset class that has the most non or negative correlation to financial assets like stocks and bonds is gold. Silver less so, because silver at a lot of times acts like a commodity and other times like a monetary asset. So when it acts as a monetary asset, it's also non-correlated. But when it acts as a commodity, it can be correlated. Okay? So that's the thing. So your first starting point is to add some precious, add some gold to your portfolio. How much? Well, we've run the numbers, and if we took a typical 60-40 stock and bond portfolio, then you need at least 10%, you know, over the, you know, the past 10 years. Today, I believe you need at least 20% for what's coming. So that's the starting point. Without knowing all the complex issues about gold.
Here we have stocks. I mean, even the bulls are a little stunned. Most estimates for the year were eclipsed S&P 500 in the first 2 weeks of the year. Things are getting a bit extended. You know, your concept and Harry Markowitz, if you've ever read his papers.
So here's a guy that won a Nobel Prize. And how many advisors, regulators, and so on have ever heard of him? And understand modern portfolio theory.
I can say this in all humility, but I actually, that was the title of my dissertation, Enhanced Modern Portfolio Theory. You know, just think of a keel of a boat. Most boats have a keel, and then they tend to be weighted as well. And this just keeps the boat, the ship, the sailboat, it keeps it afloat in rough seas. And you wouldn't even dream of lifting your sails without having that weighted keel, or at least some type of stabilizer in the water. It would be suicide. It would just capsize your boat, your ship immediately. I think it's an interesting parallel between precious metals because not only are they heavy, metallic, like a lead weight in a keel, they really truly have this negative correlation, which so aptly balances, you know, the S&P and the stocks and even the bonds to a lesser extent. And it brings your portfolio close to that zero value that we're looking for if you've read, really researched Professor Markowitz's work.
Take a traditional 60-40 portfolio and put 10 to 20% in gold, then what happens is that the standard deviation of the portfolio is reduced and the return is increased. It's that simple. It's math. It's black and white facts. There's no debate about that. Just do it, run the numbers, and you'll see the results.
But how many people understand that, you know, your standard deviation is the square root of the variance of your data? It's just that simple. Without, you know, those of us who really are fond of the minutiae and who truly enjoy breaking down the data into the expected value and the variance and then deriving our standard deviation, you have a better grasp of the true nature of risk. If you read all the great works of Nassim Taleb, who I think, yeah, only the cognoscenti have picked up on his work, because his breakthroughs, talk about deserving a Nobel Prize. And what he's pointed out is everybody blows up who does not put risk first.
Here's the second part that's a bit of a myth and is a misconception, and that is to always stay invested. There's, you know, a Wall Street saying, I think, that was attributed to the Rothschilds to say, buy stocks when there's blood in the streets. So what that means is that instead of staying fully invested, the real opportunities come not being invested and having cash available when you have a serious market decline. So let me give you an example. In 1999-2000, we had the tech bubble. And in a tech bubble, there was several large companies that acted like today's FANG stocks. So at the time, it was Cisco, IBM, Microsoft, and Oracle, I believe. Maybe one more that I can't remember. So those stocks, they were good companies throughout the period. The revenues grew, the companies grew, everything grew. However, if you stayed invested through the whole period after the decline, and it was about a 70% decline in 2000, there was only two of those stocks that broke even 2 years ago. And the rest haven't yet broken even. And there was nothing wrong with the companies. If you had liquidated at a peak and sat in cash and bought in at about 2001, you made tons of money. Those were spectacular returns then. So there's this misconception that you got to be invested. There's times like today to take your money off the table because the risk of a loss is far greater than thinking you're going to eke out the last little bit of gain. That just doesn't happen in the real world. So now you've got a risk of a 50 to a 70% decline from the markets. But when that declines, you know, if you want to take the FANG stocks as an example, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, that kind of thing, those will be 50 to 70% less in maybe a year from now, maybe 2 years from now. So far, sitting out in the out of the market, buying back then will be the greatest opportunity in your lifetime, as long as you're not invested. Instead of cash, you're far better off sitting in gold during this period, because the cash is still devaluing. The gold will go up dramatically during this period, so you'll have more money to invest in cheap stocks. So that's the other opportunity that people are missing. This will be the greatest opportunity in our lifetime to invest, as long as you're in cash or gold at the time.
Firstly, applaud your analysis here, and I think you're just 100%, maybe 105% correct. The one proviso I would toss in for everyday folks, maybe not people like Nick Barishev, I do like the idea of staying fully invested with a broad diversification. And then when one asset maybe just goes absolutely ballistic, like Bitcoin or the S&P 500, you have this incredible opportunity to take some profits and reallocate them to gold and maybe even a cash position.
Where we are today. Right now, a lot of people took their assets out of gold and reallocated it to NASDAQ and Dow stocks. So now they're overweight. Where they started with a 60-40 portfolio, they might be up to 75 to 80% in equities. If you're just going to reallocate, well, we'll reallocate back to 60-40. But the issue is still, people think, is, well, I'll be smart enough to that I'll pull out at the top. Strictly, that never happens. What happens to the average investor is we could have a situation like Japan where there was no crash. What happened in Japan was one day it went down 10%, then a little while later it went up 5%, another time it went down 20%, and then, you know, up 10%, and so on. That went on for 3 years. But if you woke up at the end of the 3 years, you were down 70%. And you didn't even notice it was happening. And what investors do is when the market goes down 10%, they'll say, well, there's going to be a recovery. I'll just wait and then I'll sell. So then the market goes up and they say, oh, that was just a blip, so I'm not going to sell. So then it goes down further. And then they get to the point when they're down 40%. Well, they can't sell. This is too big a loss. So they keep holding on until the loss becomes 50 or 70%, and then in a panic, they sell.
I'd like you to address another issue that I think really just corroborates your thoughts today, that I wonder how many professionals are really even pondering the risk of third parties with your bullion investment. You talked about the potential for risk in the general markets themselves, but I think it's easy to forget that exchange-traded funds and related funds are part of that system. It's not unencumbered. It's tied up within a clearing mechanism, which if you really start to look into a bit, looks a bit shady and underhanded, under the table.
Big misconception on ETFs, and it doesn't matter whether it's gold or equity ETFs. People think that ETFs are just like open-end mutual funds, and except for low management fees, and I can buy and sell them several times a day. They're nothing like an open-end mutual fund trust. The assets that go into an ETF come from an authorized participant, which are the big banks and brokerage houses. They're the only ones that are authorized participants. They're the only ones that effectively contribute assets or redeem assets from the ETF. So when an individual wants to, you know, buy or redeem, they're buying from the authorized participant or selling to the authorized participant. So that's number one. Now, the thing is that if you follow the money, you have to ask yourself, is Goldman Sachs going to go to the market and buy equities at net asset value contribute them to the ETF at net asset value, get new shares from the ETF at net asset value in order to sell them to their clients at net asset value. What in fact happens is Goldman Sachs borrows the assets, Goldman Sachs or any other authorized participant, borrows the assets from someone. It can be from client margin accounts, from hedge funds where they act as the prime broker, from mutual funds where they act as the prime broker, and they take these borrowed assets and contribute them to the ETF. But the assets now are double counted. Two owners. There's the original owner in the brokerage account that think he owns the asset, and there's the ETF that thinks they own the asset. So if the authorized participant becomes insolvent in the process, then you've got two claims against the same asset, and the lawyers get rich for the next 10 years. It is worse than that in the case of gold, because in the case of gold, the only place they can get gold is from the central banks. So they lease the gold from the central banks. What a lease means is that under a lease, title is not transferred. The lessor is still the owner of the asset. So the central bank still owns the asset. The authorized participant parks the asset with the GLD. And there it is in the vault for everybody to see, except that the GLD doesn't own it. The central bank still does. And if anything ever happens to the authorized participant, the central bank is simply going to send a note to the GLD and say, please send my gold back to my vault. So they think they're getting, you know, cheap gold because the management fee is only 0.5%. But in fact, they're buying into an illusion. And that gold will fall apart the very minute where you need it the most.
It sort of defeats the purpose, doesn't it? So in such an uncertain world where more than half of North American inhabitants couldn't even purchase much more than a quarter an ounce of gold, and they're too afraid to because they may need that for next month's rent or to put food on the table for the family. Is there a solution, or are we just not talking to that crowd today?
There isn't a solution for that crowd. I mean, the miles of homeless people in California, you know, are not going to be buyers of gold or silver or anything else. And so that's a whole other issue that, you know, gold and silver don't sell. But let's say for someone that's still in the middle class, the first step is that you need some physical cash at home so that there's a period which doesn't involve a total crash where the banks are closed and everything else. But you could even have like something as simple as a weather situation or a software glitch where the ATMs don't work and your credit cards don't work and so on. So start with getting a comfortable amount of physical cash, and that depends on how wealthy you are. The second step is you get physical silver coins, either Eagles or Maple Leafs, not the numismatic coins, the straight bullion coins. So that's your second level of defense. Then if you're still rich enough and you need more, that's where you buy the physical bullion to be stored in allocated storage in a non-bank vault like Brinks. So those are the different steps. You know, like I say, the starting point is simply cash. There's no downside. You take every paycheck, you take some cash out and keep building it up till you've got a good stash of cash. You know, and then you move on to silver coins, and then move on to your investment gold and silver that you don't want. People think that they should have physical possession of, but they don't understand the custodial arrangements. It needs to be allocated storage. You need to get a receipt or a statement from the vault that identifies each bar by serial number, refiner, exact weight and exact purity. Okay, that's the same like your ownership of your car says the make, model, serial number, and color. So that's what you need in gold. If you don't have that information, you don't own the gold in storage.
Can you give us an idea on whether or not you share some analysts' opinion that we may, here in North America, experience something that maybe parallels Venezuelan runaway inflation or Weimar. Of course, we're in a very different geopolitical and legal system here. Very hard, I think, to make an exact analogy. But still, in Venezuela, the situation, you know, a simple small hand of silver and gold coins today can purchase a county. And it was, as we all know, the pride of South America. Do you see something like that on our horizon?
Well, I think it's in the works. So in my Empire Club speech, which people can go on our site and you'll see the whole speech to it, together with the transcript, okay? So the issue is that China and Russia have been making moves to replace the U.S. dollar as the reserve currency. But the biggest move in that point is last year's announcement that China will be buying oil in yuan, and the yuan will be converted on the Shanghai exchange into gold. So the issue there is that Russia, Iran, and Venezuela have signed up for that. And the Saudis are getting very friendly with both Russia and China in terms of trade and arms sales. If Saudi ever switches and say, we'll sell our oil for whatever, euros, yuan, U.S. dollar, whatever comes along, then the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency is over. The only reason it's the world's reserve currency is because oil and all commodities are priced in U.S. dollars. When that happens, the U.S. dollar will lose purchasing power and will lose its value against other currencies, so it'll be more expensive to import anything. And the U.S. will become a third world country very rapidly. That's the simple reality. And it's not a theory. It's happening already, and if you go through my speech in detail, you'll see all the reasons. So these are the macro trend changes that are happening in the background that people aren't aware of.
So you might want to give people your outlook for 2018 with the precious metals and maybe even go a few years further, if you'd like.
The main issue is that at some point in the near future, there'll be a separation of the paper gold price on the COMEX and the physical gold price. Now, I've had this argument for a long time, ever since I've started the fund. And in 1998, that actually happened because Ford Motor Company bought $5 billion worth of palladium at twice the COMEX spot price in a private deal, because you can't build cars with paper palladium. So the same kind of thing will happen. So at the time you have this divergence, the gold price might be $3,000 to $5,000 an ounce. After the divergence happens, it'll go ballistic. 50,000 would not be unrealistic. And there's several pundits, Jim Rickards,
Max Kaiser, Stacy Herbert.
Max Kaiser, several of them are saying essentially the same thing. So I think that's where we are. So this year we might get to, $1,400, $1,500, that kind of a number. But now it'll keep trucking on. So now we're in this second phase of the bull market that started in 2002 and was corrected in 2011 because of the naked short selling that's on the comics. And in my transcript of this speech, I've got several charts that showed the magnitude of the naked short selling.
And imagine if that naked short selling was made transparent and the mechanism was the blockchain.
That's right. This is where this can change. But you see, the Shanghai exchange, there is no naked short selling. In order to sell something, you have to own it. So it doesn't work like the comics. It's totally bizarre that people can sell billions of dollars of gold without owning any gold. And they do the sale after hours when there is no market participants to beat up the price. No legitimate trader would ever do that.
You know, it was such an issue in France for nearly 100 years, naked short selling, that to this day it's outlawed. It destroyed their entire country. The risks posed, not just to the financial markets, but to society as a whole. We've lost at least 100 fantastic companies in this country alone due entirely to unsavory naked shorting.
Well, that's right. But in the case of equity markets, it's illegal to do naked shorting. But some of it was being done illegally. But in the futures markets, it's not illegal. You can sell as much, of any commodity that you want without owning the commodity, as long as you're good for the cash to settle in cash. That's where it totally distorts the market. So where that's ending, though, is there's class action lawsuits started in both Canada and the United States against the 6 billion banks. After the class actions was approved as a class action, Deutsche Bank, which is one of the named banks, right away settled, and they agreed to pay $60 million for gold, $38 million for silver, but most importantly, agreed to cooperate with the plaintiffs and give testimony against the other bank.
You know, I'm just convinced that the transparency that will arise from the blockchain phenomenon will eventually work its way into the precious metals, because so many in the gold crowd have been disparaging cryptos, Bitcoin, things of that nature, altcoins. And I can see why, because certainly it's drawn attention away from bullion. But if you can step back and take a bigger look, and this is the topic of a lot of our shows, that what it's really done is exposed the cracks in the fiat money fiasco around the world. When a digital number that's essentially encoded is suddenly worth 18,000 times more than a U.S. dollar? Imagine what happens when that system brings to light the schemes that have been behind the gold money suppression for 30 years.
Well, where this boils down to is the late 60s, early 70s. The typical investor institution or otherwise held 5% in gold, okay? And today, what's happened is the financial assets have grown, and the gold price has also grown, but been relatively moderate. So what happens when 5% of the financial assets today decide that they need to buy 5% in gold? Well, the numbers, what that works out to is out of the financial assets, which are about, look it up, $294 trillion. 5% of $294 trillion is about $14 trillion. Now, the amount of above-ground investment gold, even though there's been 180,000 tons, mined, since, throughout history, there's only about 1.8 trillion of actual investment-grade gold. Now, how much of that is for sale is unknown, because a lot of that is owned by very wealthy families like the Rothschilds that won't sell it at any price. But even if we took that figure of 1.8 trillion at face value, and if we moved up to just 5% of global portfolios to gold, then what you've got is 14.7 trillion of cash chasing 1.8 trillion of above ground investment bullion. So in order for that to work, mine production is falling, so you can't increase mine supply. So the only thing that can happen is you can adjust the price. To adjust the price, the gold price has to go up about eightfold to about 10,500 per ounce. And when people panic a little bit, that's what will happen. They'll be moving out of financial assets into physical gold.
You haven't even brought into your equation yet the prospect of leverage, margin.
That's almost taking the best case scenario.
You're saying, look, folks, this is headed your way. That's your best case. So heaven help you if the momentum traders, and I can't imagine why they would get interested in such an amazing opportunity, suddenly turn their trillions on this tiny, I guess, $7 to $10 trillion precious metals market. The amazing climb of the cryptos, once again, I keep running to it. We don't have to cover it. If we can see those types of over 1 million-fold gains in Bitcoin, I think it gives you a litmus test.
It gives you an idea of what could happen when the gold's momentum starts rising, which it will this year.
I'm asking all my guests, do you believe it's possible that the cryptos are telegraphing a Weimar, a Zimbabwe, a Venezuelan-style fiat collapse is imminent?
The only thing to remember about cryptos, though, is that as a potential momentum indicator, I agree. It'll be a good example of the kind of momentum that can be achieved in gold.
I think you're right, and I think that we're already seeing that because many of the top Bitcoin whales are turning to gold this year because obviously Bitcoin got to bubble levels. So what do you turn to? You can't turn to equities, and you can't go to the 30-year bond bubble. I mean, palladium is just the gem of the metals commodity sector. We see something like that erupting in the precious metals today. Any closing comments on the metal sector?
Well, just that I think that starting point is diversify and start with at least 10% in physical bullion, then, you know, go from there. So that's the recommendation. 0.5% today in terms of allocation between institutional private investors. 0.5% is what everybody holds in gold. That's not nearly enough.
Exactly. You know, I think you made a good point earlier that typically 10%, but in this environment, 20%. And as these other asset bubbles continue to blow up even larger as the equities, you know, who knows? Will we see 50,000 or 100,000 before the peak? I mean, they can, with these deep pockets, as we said, print as much money as they want, plunge protection team and other entities on Wall Street. So
it's like there's an old Wall Street saying, put 10% of your money into gold and hope it doesn't work.
In this instance, you're saying put 20% in gold because it's going to work.
Well, that's right.
All right, Nick Bereshef, just a pleasure, as always, hearing your thoughts. Any contact information on BMG Group?
It is bmggroup.com. There, they, like I say, they can go to our market insights section and get the entire Empire Club speech and the transcript, and there'll be some very important insights there in terms of the macro trend changes.
All right, Nick Bereshef, always a pleasure. Please return in 2018 to keep us updated with all your gold insights.
Okay, my pleasure.